Thank you for being here. Thank you for having me here. As always, I'm always encouraged by how many people turn out for a seminar like this on the weekend. We've got so many things that vie for our time today. And I believe this is a subject of critical importance today, especially among those that are college age, as there is a mass exodus from the church and Christendom at large due to this subject of naturalism. And so we'll be taking a look at that throughout the rest of this weekend. So evolution is the atheist's explanation for how the universe got here. The naturalist, the person who believes that everything has to be explained in some sort of natural way without any kind of supernatural intervention. So if naturalistic evolution can be shown to be not legitimate, not in harmony with the evidence, and therefore irrational, then theism, some form of theism, the existence of God, stands as the only logical possibility in harmony with the evidence for how the universe got here. And there's several gaping chasms in the atheistic explanation for the origin of the universe, for life, for man. And these are significant questions that simply cannot be answered by the naturalist, the atheist, but which have to be answered before naturalistic evolution can be, so the Big Bang and Darwinian evolution could be even considered a possibility, much less a fact. And we looked at a few of those in our last session. How could the laws of science come into existence on their own? How could a law write itself? How could matter and energy come into existence before the alleged Big Bang, which, an idea which I don't agree with anyway, but even if you do agree with that, how did the matter and energy come into existence before that? How could anything create itself? As a fitting review of that lecture last night, British evolutionary biologist and atheist of Oxford University, in a television interview in 2012, this is what he said. Of course, it's counterintuitive that you can get something from nothing. Of course, common sense doesn't allow you to get something from nothing. That's why it's interesting. It's got to be interesting in order to give rise to the universe at all. Something pretty mysterious had to give rise to the origin of the universe. He believes that this problem for atheists is interesting. Apparently to him, yeah, it's not really a problem. It's just interesting. Really? Something pretty mysterious had to give rise to the origin of the universe. Well, hey, I'll give him that. In the previous session, we looked at three laws of science, the first and second laws of thermodynamics and the law of causality, in order to see what science has to say about some of these questions. And a summary of the implications of those laws is here on the screen. In this session, we're going to look at three other areas of science to see what they have to say about the matter of origins. The laws of science have been discovered, as I said last night, through extensive scientific investigation of the evidence. They are, by definition, a concluding statement about the scientific evidence, and therefore they're rational. Laws of science are rational. They're concluding statements from the evidence. If anything can be said to be scientific, it's the laws of science. And ultimately, the laws of science present major unresolvable issues for the naturalistic evolutionary mindset. The creation model, on the other hand, as we saw last night, is always in perfect harmony with the laws of science. In fact, it even predicts their effects. No one has directly observed God. No one was there to witness the origin of the universe or life, to witness whether it was God or a Big Bang that started it all. Nobody knows, on either side of the aisle. No one was alive to see the flood, at least nobody today. And no one has been alive long enough to directly witness firsthand whether or not Darwinian evolution has happened. Nobody's actually witnessed that. But we can arrive at the answers to what happened by examining the aftermath of these events, by examining indirect evidence. I mentioned forensic science briefly yesterday. It can be used for legal purposes to help determine what happened in an accident or in a crime or some other event. Forensic scientists can often determine who did what, how they did it, even when they did it, without the scientists actually having witnessed whatever happened. And similarly, studying our natural surroundings can reveal to us how the universe got here. The question that a person has to ask, which model is better in harmony with the actual evidence, creation or evolution, theism or atheism? In this seminar, we're examining evolution, which is the atheistic explanation to see if it in fact harmonizes with the evidence. Probability, intimately intertwined with science. Scientists constantly study causes and effects, and we try to determine all the factors that go into producing a certain effect, knowing that we can't account for all of those factors. And since we can't get perfect equations and can't account for every factor, we have to rely on probability, statistics. We look at past results and we get statistics on those results so we can figure out how likely it is that something will or won't happen. In other words, we determine probabilities. Mark Kack was a famous mathematician and professor at Cornell and Rockefeller Universities. He said, probability is a cornerstone of all the sciences, and its daughter, the science of statistics, enters into all human activities. Evolutionists understand the significance of probability in science, and probability can be fine and good. Now, here's the problem. Evolutionists, in trying to defend atheism, go too far in their use of probability and its laws. Some scientists will argue anything will happen if you just give it enough time. It doesn't matter how far-fetched it is, as long as it doesn't have a probability of zero. And they claim, since evolution supposedly doesn't have a probability of zero, then as long as it has enough time to do its work, it's going to happen. It's inevitable. Supposedly, objects will just pop into existence, and eventually they'll grow the necessary components and come to life and start strolling around. And with a little bit of magic and sleight of hand, poof, eventually they can even become humans. As long as those things don't have a probability of zero, and as long as you throw enough time at the problem. Evolutionists have long cited the principles of probability, trying to find grounds to support naturalistic evolution. As far back as 1954, Nobel laureate George Wald of Harvard, writing in Scientific American concerning abiogenesis, which is the idea that life can come from non-life, he said, however improbable we regard this event, the event talking about abiogenesis, or any of the steps it involves, given enough time, it will almost certainly happen at least once. And for life as we know it, once may be enough. Time is the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible becomes probable, and the probable becomes virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs miracles. This is a Nobel laureate from Harvard here. Well, there's at least four problems with that statement about the nature of the laws of probability, and I address that more in depth in my book. Let's look at three for the sake of time. First of all, even if you were to concede that if you just have an exorbitant amount of time, that could somehow allow for evolution to occur, you still have a problem because we're simply not given that much time for it to have occurred. Do you know that there's over 70 different scientific dating techniques based on actually standard evolutionary assumptions, which all indicate that the Earth is actually relatively young? You don't hear about that, do you? They don't emphasize that in the school system because they don't support this naturalistic agenda. You know, science today is loaded with naturalism. If it's not purely natural, it's not science, and so you can't rely on any dating technique that gives you a short amount of time. You can't do that because it's going to disallow naturalism. A second problem comes up when the evolutionist claims that evolution is inevitable given enough time. It comes from this work of evolutionist Emile Borel. He's a renowned French mathematician for whom the Borel lunar crater is named. And in three books, he discussed in depth what is known as the single law of chance, which states that events whose probability is extremely small never occur. At least, he says, quote, we must act in all circumstances as if they were impossible. And the law, he said, applies to the sort of events which, though its impossibility may not be rationally demonstrable, is, however, so unlikely that no sensible person will hesitate to declare it actually impossible. If someone affirmed having observed such an event, we would be sure that he's deceiving us or has himself been the victim of a fraud. Strong words. In other words, there are some events that you can't directly prove to be impossible, but sensible people still consider them to be impossible. A person may be able to calculate the probability of something ridiculous happening, but that doesn't really make it possible because we have common sense and we have intuition, and intuitively we human beings know that there's some things that simply won't happen, and we treat them as such unless somebody has just told you that it could, even if you know it's crazy, enough times where eventually you just believe it. So we disregard these things and their possibilities without even giving it a second thought. Burrell tried to put a number on this idea. So what did he mean when he said events with extremely small probabilities don't occur? That's kind of vague, isn't it? Well, so Burrell gets more specific in his books, and he tries to put some skin on the bones, if you will. So he starts from a human perspective, and he determines what the typical human being considers to be a negligible probability, and tries to put a number on what human beings consider to be, in essence, impossible events. For example, there is a possibility that a few monkeys with scissors and dozens of magazines working away for weeks and weeks could cut out the necessary words and organize them in such a way as to perfectly reproduce the complete works of Shakespeare. Do you know you could actually put a number on that possibility? But don't we as humans know intuitively that's not going to happen? And it doesn't matter how much time you give them. Our common sense says no, no. We know that a mind would be necessary to recreate such works. Just because a person tries to calculate the probability of something ridiculous happening, it doesn't really mean it could ever occur. We have common sense, we have intuition, we know that there are some things that simply won't happen, and we treat them as such. We disregard their possibilities without even a second thought. Another example, there's a possibility, a very minute probability, that if you lock an ape in a room with a laptop computer, he could potentially recreate perfectly the Encyclopedia Britannica by just randomly banging on keys. Again, you can put a number on that possibility. Does that actually make it an event that would occur? Okay, so the naturalist irrationally says, well, it could happen, and so evolution could happen too. Well, not really. Believe it or not, researchers at Plymouth University in England conducted a test with six Sulawesi-crested macaques. Six of these apes on the screen. Now, their goal was to see what would happen if six apes were left alone with a computer. And their names were Elmo, Gum, Heather, Holly, Mistletoe, and Rowan. You think they accidentally created a Shakespeare book? What do you think happened? How about a page? How about a single paragraph? A sentence? Surely a word, right? According to Mike Phillips, one of the researchers, the first thing that happened was the lead male got a stone and started bashing it. Right? He went on to say another thing they were interested in is marking this keyboard as their territory. Now, isn't that what you would expect to happen? I mean, seriously, people. You know, humans have common sense that tells us these monkeys are not going to be able to replicate the works of Shakespeare. It doesn't matter how much time you give them. It doesn't matter what you say the odds are. Did they ever produce anything? They did eventually produce 5 pages of text, but it was composed primarily of the letter S and A, J, L, and M from time to time. Mike Phillips said they pressed a lot of S's. Obviously, English isn't their first language. So not one word of the English language was even stumbled across. But honestly, again, wouldn't we expect that? Doesn't our common sense tell us that's what's going to happen? This isn't a matter of probability. There are some things that just won't occur, regardless of how much time you give and no matter what you say the odds are. It's really not a matter of probability. Burrell, in essence, developed a law that would help to quantify these kind of impossible events. He determined the probability for those events that the typical reasonable individual would consider to be impossible, like the probability of monkeys recreating the works of Shakespeare. And then he stepped back and mathematically extrapolated the probability of negligible events from an entire earthly perspective as a whole, rather than just from the individual perspective. And finally, he extrapolated the probability of impossible universal cosmic events that would fall under the single law of chance. Ultimately, concerning those cosmic events, he argues using mathematics that humans consider probabilities of chance cosmic events that are less than 1 in 10 to the 45th power to be impossible. That's a number, again, arrived at logically by this renowned mathematician and evolutionist. Now, in other words, if the probability of a certain event happening in the universe is less than 1 in 10 to the 45th power, that's a 1 with 45 zeros after it, our intuition tells human beings to categorize that event as so unlikely that we would consider it to be an impossible event and not worthy of our consideration. Now, here's the problem. If atheistic evolution is true, then abiogenesis has to be true. Life had to come from non-life. Life spontaneously generated, created itself. Now, how does that relate to the single law of chance? Evolutionist Harold Marowitz of Yale University, currently he's a professor of biology and natural philosophy at George Mason University, he estimated the probability of the formation of the smallest and simplest living organism to be 1 in 10 to the 340 millionth power. Now, according to the single law of chance, that's a probability so far under what we would consider negligible that you can't even fathom that number. The implication from the single law of chance is that the random chance formation of even the smallest, simplest living organism would not occur. It's not worthy of our attention. According to Borel, any sensible person would disregard the possibility of life coming from non-life, considering that to be an impossible event. One in 10 to the 45th power is this number on top. Okay? The bottom number is only 1 in 10 to the negative 1,000th power. You have to add 340,000 sets of that many zeros to have 1 in 10 to the negative 340 millionth power. The estimated probability of the formation of the smallest and simplest living organism, according to evolutionist Harold Marowitz of Yale. That sound like a pretty slim chance to you? How about this? The late renowned evolutionist Carl Sagan made his own estimation of the chance that life could evolve on any single given planet, 1 in 10 to the 2 billionth power, okay? That's 2 million sets of that many zeros on the screen. And what's more, you have to keep in mind that these calculations were made some time back before much of the more recent research, which reveals with even more clarity the complexity of life. Again, probability estimates for the formation of life made by evolutionists themselves so far beyond the limit Borel stated for these cosmic events by the single law of chance. It's really not funny. It's shocking. It's shocking to me. Because the creation model has been considered the irrational one, and it's been shoved under this bushel and thrown off the table in the scientific community, even though it's really the logical conclusion here from the evidence. If you've got life that's that complex, you need some mind that created it. Naturalistic evolution, it's far-fetched and it's mystical, and I'll say this many times this weekend, it's witchcraft without a witch. Common sense, intuition, reason, mathematics, all points to the conclusion evolution and therefore atheism is not possible, even granting the evolutionists' own assumptions. The distinguished atheistic British astronomer Sir Frederick Hoyle, he once said regarding evolution, the chance that higher forms have emerged in this way is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. He further said, at all events, anyone with even a nodding acquaintance with the Rubik Cube will concede the near impossibility of a solution being obtained by a blind person moving the cubic faces at random, right? You think a blind person's going to be able to solve the Rubik Cube? Now imagine 10 to the 50th power blind persons, each with a scrambled Rubik Cube, and try to conceive of the chance of them all simultaneously arriving at the solved form. That gets even more crazy. You then have the chance of arriving by random shuffling of just one of the many biopolymers on which life depends. The notion that not only by biopolymers, but the operating program of a living cell could be arrived at by chance in a primordial organic soup here on the earth is evidently nonsense of a high order. The simultaneous placing of all the necessary pieces of the puzzle to form only one of life's biopolymers through blind chance, random accidents, as well as the program that controls the behavior of that cell at the same time, according to this famous scientist and evolutionist, Fred Hoyle, that's nonsense. Science simply doesn't support such a fairy tale scenario. No wonder Richard Dawkins, writing in New Scientist, said, "The more statistically improbable a thing is, the less we can believe that it just happened by blind chance. Superficially, the obvious alternative to chance is an intelligent designer." Yeah, okay. He, of course, rejects that obvious alternative, but at least he admits that common sense tells the average human being that blind chance can't account for what we see in the universe. An intelligent designer is obvious to anybody that's using their common sense. Now, there's an important note, though, that I need to attach to this whole discussion here. In actuality, even discussing these probabilities can be misleading to you. By even discussing the idea, I don't want to leave the impression with anybody that there's even a minute possibility of evolution occurring, however ridiculously small that chance may be. See, when I give the example of the apes cutting scraps from magazines and making Shakespeare books, or banging randomly on a computer to make the Encyclopedia Britannica, you can calculate probabilities on those events, small though they may be, because there's an input device. There's a keyboard in existence, for example. And therefore, there's a chance that the animal could randomly punch the right key at any moment, right? The evolutionary models, you notice it's not even a direct parallel to that scenario. Why? Because the evolutionary model would be more like the monkey being in a room with a computer and there being no keyboard or input device for the computer. There is no scientific evidence that supports the belief that something physical could exist forever, that something physical could come from nothing, that life could come from non-life, that one kind of creature could give rise to a completely different kind, that scientific laws could write themselves into existence. And we could keep going. There's dozens of examples that could be given. All of these things have to be true in order for evolution to be valid. In other words, for the evolutionary model, there's no existing keyboard for the monkeys to even punch. And really, it's worse than that. There's not a computer. In fact, there's not even a monkey to do the punching. There's nothing. The room's empty. The atheistic evolutionary model, which rejects God, starts with nothing in the room and then claims that the works of Shakespeare could come into existence. How can a probability be calculated on nothing? So we're really not talking about probability here, right? Evolution is not a matter of probability, it's a matter of impossibility. How could a non-existent monkey replicate an encyclopedia on a non-existent computer with a non-existent keyboard? It's not just improbable, that's impossible. How could evolution start with nothing, as well as no means of getting anything, and end up with everything? Chew on that for a minute. You know, it's not like there's a little bit of evidence that would back up the idea that that kind of thing could occur, that at least would get you going. Moving in a certain direction, you got a little bit of evidence. That's not what the atheist has. Instead of any supporting evidence, the evolutionist starts with all of the evidence saying, no, you can't do that. Not only is there no evidence that could be used to even potentially support the idea that life could come from non-life, there's actually abundant evidence that says, no, you can't do that. And since there's zero evidence that such a thing could occur, then according to the evidence, there's a zero probability of it occurring. So the third problem with the statement that evolution is inevitable given enough time comes from the probability rule known as Kolmogorov's first axiom. According to this probabilistic rule, when the probability of an event is zero, the event is defined as an impossible event. You see, all probabilities do is try to find trends that have been observed to occur in the past by observing the natural order, the universe. So if there's an event that has never been shown to be able to occur in nature, like the spontaneous generation of matter or life, then the event stands as having a zero probability. You can't just wave your hands and magically give a probability to something that science has repeatedly proven that doesn't happen. You know, it's not like spontaneous generation has been shown to occur 1 in 3 million tries, right? That would give it a probability. That's not what science has shown. There is no evidence to support a probability of anything other than zero for several evolutionary events. The only way you can say it has a probability is if you say supernaturalism is false, so it had to happen. That gives it a probability. But wait a minute. Your assumption is inappropriate. That's a false assumption you just made there. The natural evidence says that doesn't happen. Now, since several events that are necessary in order for atheistic theories to be true indeed have a probability of zero, then according to the laws of probability, these atheistic theories are impossible. So even if time could help in the process, which it can't, the time that evolutionists claim is needed for their theory is simply not available. Plus, the single law of chance prohibits several evolutionary events, and plus, we know Kolmogorov's first axiom tells us that these evolutionary events are actually defined as impossible events. Probability does not support naturalistic evolution. The creation model, once again, is fine with the evidence because it doesn't require causeless leaps from nothing to everything and from non-life to life. Since naturalistic explanations of the universe are not in harmony with the statistical evidence, a supernatural explanation is warranted by the evidence, a contention that is in harmony with what we would predict. If the God of the Bible exists, there is a 100% probability that he created the universe and life. There's a probability for you. No probabilistic rule violated. What about the well-known and highly respected law of biogenesis? This is a law which describes how life works, where life comes from in nature. In order for naturalism, atheistic evolution, to be possible, the atheist has to have an explanation for where life came from without resorting to a creator. So ultimately, in the evolutionary model, life had to come into existence from non-living substances. For millennia, really up to just a few hundred years ago, it was a common belief that life could, in fact, spring into existence from non-life, just pop into existence on its own. This is a belief known as spontaneous generation or abiogenesis. Then in the 1600s, Italian scientist Francesco Redi conducted scientific tests which cast some serious doubt on this idea of spontaneous generation. Some were skeptical of his experiments and still thought that it could occur. So Lazzaro Spallanzani conducted his own test to investigate the criticisms of the skeptics, and he further substantiated the fact abiogenesis doesn't happen. Rather, life comes only from life. Still, many were skeptical. And then in 1864, French scientist Louis Pasteur conducted experiments which drove the nails into the proverbial coffin on spontaneous generation. One standard high school biology textbook, a textbook that's evolution-based, mind you, said it wasn't until 1864, in the elegant experiment of French scientist Louis Pasteur, that the hypothesis of spontaneous generation was finally disproved. Pasteur, like Redi and Spallanzani before him, had shown that life comes only from life. Now notice, people used to believe in the superstitious idea that life sprang into existence. And textbooks have long championed the work of Pasteur as solid science. It disproves such a ridiculous notion, and they champion that. And yet now what do we have? We've come full circle. It's not so superstitious and ridiculous anymore. It's considered a legitimate possibility. Life could come, you know, from non-life. This is a legitimate possibility now. But you know, life only comes from life. Even the evolutionists will concede that truth. Granted, they'll admit it begrudgingly. The fact that life comes only from life is what is known as the law of biogenesis. So with that knowledge, the best the atheistic evolutionist can do is try to prove that abiogenesis still could happen in spite of the mounds of scientific evidence that have been gathered so far, which repudiates all of this, repudiates this idea. All of this scientific experimentation and gathered data, Redi, Spallanzani, Pasteur, scientists never having observed any exception to the rule, and yet sadly, naturalists simply refuse to accept the conclusion from the scientific evidence. What's that called? What are they being? Irrational. Instead, they pour endless hours, mounds of money in trying to get around the truth of the law of biogenesis. There's an entire field called origin of life studies. People go and get degrees in this. Just ignore the God option. Don't even consider it a possibility. Refuse to accept the evidence. Instead, gather more. Let's see if we can contradict the evidence. Does that sound reasonable to you? It doesn't to me. There have been a stream of attempts to find evidence that life could come from non-life, to try to find evidence to substantiate evolution. And guess what? All of these attempts, without exception, have shown life comes from non-life. Life doesn't come from non-life. Just make sure you're listening. It's further illustrated that life comes only from life. There's no exception to this. Thus, biogenesis is a law. And the implication is that abiogenesis is impossible. Martin Moe is a prominent marine biologist and evolutionist. He said, a century of sensational discoveries in the biological science, the sciences has taught us that life arises only from life. Evolutionist George Gaylord Simpson, perhaps the most influential paleontologist of the 20th century, he said, there's no serious doubt that biogenesis is the rule, that life comes only from other life, that a cell, the unit of life, is always and exclusively the product or offspring of another cell. In the biology textbook, Biology, A Search for Order in Complexity, Moore and Slusher wrote, historically, the point of view that life comes only from life has been so well established through the facts revealed by experiment that it is called the law of biogenesis. What does the scientific evidence indicate about the origin of life? Well, life creates life. And even the evolutionists, like these, admit that, and yet they refuse to accept the implications. If atheistic evolution is true, life had to come from non-life, but it can't, according to the evidence. Belief in abiogenesis is a stubborn refusal to accept the scientific evidence that we have at our disposal, choosing instead to believe in evolutionary superstition, myths, and fairy tales. You know, evolution is just modern superstition. That's what it is. It's a religion of its own. The evidence is available. The evidence has spoken. In light of the extensive amount of scientific evidence against abiogenesis, how can the theory of evolution be given any attention, any credence? How do the evolutionists respond to the evidence against abiogenesis? Well, amazingly, one typical response is for them to just come out and admit, come out and concede life can't come from non-life. Just admit it's impossible. It can't happen. Evolutionist and Nobel Prize winner George Wald of Harvard, who I quoted earlier, he said, one has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible, yet here we are as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. It's impossible, but I won't believe in God because somehow that's crazy and this isn't. Really? Abiogenesis must have happened. You know, it's common for evolution-based high school biology textbooks to just come out and admit spontaneous generation is impossible. They come out and show the work of Pasteur and just champion the idea that he disproved this crazy old superstitious idea. Like this one by the popular textbook publisher Prentice Hall, after discussing Pasteur's experiments, the authors say the hypothesis of spontaneous generation was finally disproved. Guess what happened literally on the next page? They promoted evolution and the origin of life from non-life. Every biology textbook I've seen from the last few decades shows the work of Pasteur and how he disproved abiogenesis, except one. I finally found a textbook that kicked Pasteur out. The 2000 edition of this very textbook eliminated the discussion entirely. And so I contacted the authors. And Miller wrote me back. And he said, well, it was Levine that wrote that chapter. He passed the buck. And he said, but I can guess. I mean, it's just we got so many things to cover in here that, we decided to go another route. It's not like anything's changed with regard to the evidence. They just don't really have space for that anymore. Well, you know what? I could infer what's really going on there, couldn't you? They're tired of hearing us make this argument. Because they've taught us in the textbooks for so long, life comes from life. So wait a minute, evolution can't happen. They're tired of that argument, so now it's like censorship. They've given the boot to the whole discussion of Pasteur, even though his work is hands down an excellent example of how science works. And that's how the textbooks have always portrayed us. Sir Fred Hoyle, who's a distinguished atheistic British astronomer, and Chandra Wickramasinghe, professor of anatomy and applied mathematics at University College in Wales. I quoted Hoyle earlier. They said, the probability of life originating at random is so utterly minuscule as to make the random concept absurd. Evolutionist J.D. Bernal, one of the leading scientists among X-ray crystallographers, he said, it is possible to demonstrate effectively how life could not have arisen. The improbabilities are too great, the chances of the emergence of life too small. Regrettably, from this point of view, life is here on Earth, and the arguments have to be bent around to support its existence. That's the naturalistic mindset. You know, and I'm not saying at all that they're all dishonest. They believe that the assumption of naturalism is the way to go. And so therefore, it really doesn't matter if the evidence speaks out against this. It had to happen. Life had to come from non-life. And so just ignore the evidence. Just ignore it and keep promoting naturalistic evolution. No wonder the McGraw-Hill Dictionary of Scientific and Technical Terms, which is not creationist friendly by any means, it actually defines abiogenesis as the obsolete concept that plant and animal life arise from non-living organic matter. Now, wait a minute. If abiogenesis is impossible, if a belief like that is obsolete, how could evolution be considered credible by so many people? How did life get here without it? When you press for an answer to that question, many evolutionists literally throw up their hands and admit we don't have a clue. The late evolutionist John Maddox, writing in the prominent science magazine Nature, he said, it's disappointing that the origin of the genetic code is still as obscure as the origin of life itself. We don't have a clue. Evolutionary geologist Robert Hazen of Harvard, he said, The origin of life is a subject of immense complexity, and I have to tell you right up front, we don't know how life began. How can I tell you about the origin of life when we're so woefully ignorant of that history? Notice the name of this lecture series he's doing. It's called Origin. That's the whole lecture series. This guy from Harvard, and he tells the class right up front, we don't really know. So that, what does that tell you about the rest of the class? It's a bunch of speculation, you know, and just ignore the evidence and forget all of that work, and just now you've moved into this witchcraft class, this superstition class, and you deem it science, and you get a lot of people that back you because they're all naturalistic people that don't want God in the picture. That's what we've got ruling the classrooms. Evolutionist Paul Davies, theoretical physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist, professor at Arizona State University, I quoted him last night, writing in New Scientist in 2006. He said, one of the great outstanding scientific mysteries is the origin of life. How did it happen? The truth is, nobody has a clue. Well, I disagree with him about nobody. Him and his evolutionary colleagues don't have a clue. And the 2008 documentary Expelled, famous evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, who I've quoted a few times, due to his prominence in the evolutionary community, he discussed the origin of life with Ben Stein. Dawkins said, nobody knows how it got started. We know the kind of event that it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life. It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule. Stein said, right. And how did that happen? Dawkins said, I've told you, we don't know. Stein said, so you have no idea how it started. Dawkins says, no, nor has anybody. Well, of course you don't know how it could happen because it's been scientifically proven that it can't. So naturalistic evolution can't happen. But again, he's claiming not only does he not know how life started, but according to him, nobody does. So this extremely prominent evolutionist, considered one of the leaders in the field, admits nobody has a clue how life began. So they're not being able to create life in a lab. Nobody has a clue how life began. To all intents and purposes, it's impossible that it could have created itself. So what is the naturalist left with? Well, a recent response to this whole problem by these evolutionists is to just try to dodge the problem. Don't even face it. Don't answer it. Just claim that the origin of life is irrelevant to evolution, since the theory of evolution supposedly has nothing to do with the origin of life. It starts with life already in existence and then just tells us how we get the species from that. That's kind of sneaky, isn't it? I address this more thoroughly in my book, but briefly. First of all, this dodge only potentially helps you if you're a theistic evolutionist and you believe God jumped in and kick-started life at the right time. If you're a theistic evolutionist, if you believe in God, why would you try to kick him out of the classroom, as the bulk of the evolutionary community is doing? In truth, it's the naturalist who's trying to kick God out of the classroom, and the theory of evolution is the naturalist theory. That's how it was designed. If naturalism is correct, cosmic evolution has to be correct, which includes Darwinian evolution, which has to start with abiogenesis at some point. You can't dodge this. That's why historically, abiogenesis has been considered a fundamental assumption of evolution. Years ago, Gerald A. Kirkut, who's a British zoologist and physiologist of Cambridge, he listed abiogenesis as the first of seven non-provable assumptions upon which evolution is based. He said, the first assumption is that non-living things gave rise to living material, i.e. spontaneous generation, occurred. This is a non-provable assumption, he admits, and evolution is based on that. Abiogenesis has always been an assumed component of evolution in spite of the evidence against it. The problem can't be dodged. The evidence doesn't support evolution. It's unscientific. So what are they left with? How could life get started on Earth without God? Enter directed panspermia. In order to come up with an answer to this problem without conceding God, some are literally leaving the planet. There is a growing belief in the claim that aliens brought life here and seeded it billions of years ago and then directed the evolution of life since then. You know, after all, if evolution were true, it would be inconceivable that there would not be aliens somewhere out there. Isn't that the whole point of Star Trek? Right? It relies on that. Sir Frederick Hoyle and Professor Wickramasinghe here on record as subscribing to that view, as well as Nobel laureate Sir Francis Crick, and Richard Dawkins. Naturalists will do anything to avoid the idea of God. There's absolutely no evidence of extraterrestrial life. It's pure speculation and wishful thinking for the atheist to try to solve the abiogenesis problem by resorting to aliens. That's why evolutionary astrophysicist and astronomy journalist Stuart Clark says concerning the alien seeding theory, its probability is so remote it should be left aside. And yet evolutionists are still buying into the idea, of course, because they don't have many options. Consider Richard Dawkins' comments in Ben Stein's documentary, Expelled. Dawkins talks about the possibility of intelligent design. He says, it could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now, that's a possibility and an intriguing possibility. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of our chemistry, molecular biology. You might find a signature of some kind of designer, and that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Now, wait a minute. Before we go any further, notice Dawkins, one of the most famous atheists of our day, admits that there could be evidence of design in our bodies and our chemistry. Really? That's an argument that we've been making for centuries. It's called the teleological argument for the existence of God. The design in the universe demands a designer. Dawkins actually conceded this, the possibility of God, by making that statement. Now, granted, he flat out rejects the idea that that designer is the God of the Bible. Instead, he accepts aliens. There's no evidence for aliens. Guess what? There is evidence for the God of the Bible, because the Bible has supernatural characteristics which can't be explained from human hands. That's evidence, people. Aliens? That's irrational. This illustrates the prejudice that many in the atheistic community have against God. Now, notice also what Dawkins said about those aliens. That higher intelligence would itself had to have come about by some ultimately explicable process. It couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously. Okay, so according to Dawkins, the supposed alien creators have now been strapped with the laws of nature too. They couldn't have just popped into existence. He recognizes the truth of the law of biogenesis and that it applies everywhere in the whole universe. He acknowledges that biogenesis would still have to be in effect on their home planet. So he admits that the problem of abiogenesis still isn't even solved by this whole alien seeding idea. It's just been moved to the alien's homeland, where the question of the origin of life still has to be answered without resorting to abiogenesis. So let's get this straight. According to evolutionists, the origin of life through spontaneous generation, a fundamental plank of evolutionary theory, it's impossible. And the best they can do is just to try to dodge the issue or make up aliens. And you can't blame them. I mean, again, what else do you have left to try to explain the origin of life? A miracle? How ironic it is that many evolutionists have started using religious terminology like that to describe the origin of life, albeit they use the terminology incorrectly from a biblical perspective, and they use that terminology in spite of the fact that they've long attacked creationists for using any kind of miraculous type terminology. Recall the renowned evolutionary astronomer Robert Jastrow. He said, at present, science has no satisfactory answer to the question of the origin of life on Earth. Perhaps the appearance of life on the Earth is a miracle. Scientists are reluctant to accept this view, but their choices are limited. Abiogenesis is also an act of faith. The act of faith consists in assuming that the scientific view of the origin of life is correct without having concrete evidence to support that belief. Now, what is this called, people? What is this called? Being irrational. And notice the word faith here is used in the denominational sense. It's the view that faith isn't based on evidence, but is merely this leap into the dark, accepting something without adequate evidence. That, of course, is not the biblical view of faith. Our faith in God is, in fact, based on the evidence. But the amazing thing is that some of the evolutionists are actually beginning to realize and admit that they lack evidence for their belief, that it's literally a genuine, blind, evidenceless faith that they're holding to by accepting evolution and abiogenesis. They're actually beginning to equate evolution with religion, which it is. Evolutionist and Nobel Prize winner Sir Francis Crick, who co-discovered the double helix structure of the DNA molecule, he acknowledged, an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense, The origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it along. Evolutionary physiologist and zoologist George A. Kirkut said that spontaneous generation is a matter of faith on the part of the biologist. The evidence for what did happen is not available. So ultimately, evolutionists don't have a clue how the theory of evolution could even get started. Abiogenesis is impossible. Its occurrence would have been miraculous. But of course, really, what Dawkins and Davies and these other guys, whenever they, you know, say things like that, it's a miracle, we don't have a clue, nobody does. What they really mean is, again, no naturalist has a clue. No atheistic evolutionist has a clue. Biblical supernaturalists, on the other hand, know exactly how life originated. And that belief is perfectly in harmony with the law of biogenesis, as you would expect it to be. If the evidence indicates that in nature, life can only come from other similar life, then logically the only way to be consistent with the evidence is to realize there must be something outside of nature that initiated life. That's the only option in harmony with what we actually have in front of us regarding scientific evidence. And the biblical model, of course, says that that's exactly what happened. How did living beings come to be according to the creation model? By a supernatural God bringing it into existence. Jehovah God created life. He created living creatures. Life didn't spring into existence from nothing. God breathed life into man when he created him. Bottom line, the creation model is once again the scientific choice. The naturalistic evolutionary model is unscientific. Now, another implication of the law of biogenesis comes from the work of Rudolf Virchow. His work illustrated that not only does life come from life, but life comes only from life of its kind. The McGraw-Hill Dictionary of Scientific and Technical Terms confirms this, defining biogenesis as the development of a living organism from a similar living organism. One popular life science textbook put it this way. Another characteristic of organisms is the ability to reproduce or produce offspring that are similar to the parents. For example, robins lay eggs that develop into young robins that closely resemble their parents. Robins make robins. There may be small differences in color and height and beak size and so forth. Differences and changes that we call microevolution that creates diversity, which can be scientifically verified from evidence as change, which actually occurs and which the creationist doesn't have a problem with. But even though there are changes, the offspring is still a robin. It's not a rhino and it's not a whale. Macroevolution has not happened. So in nature, life comes only from life of its own kind. Dogs don't have cats and horses don't have cows and frogs don't have snakes and apes don't give rise to humans. But if evolution is true, isn't that in essence what had to happen? Simple lower life sprang into existence, and from that, over eons of time, complex life came about. So according to evolution, life does not come from life of its kind, but rather from other kinds of life, in contradiction to the actual evidence, the law of biogenesis. In the field of philosophy, there's a law known as the law of excluded middle. And that law says that every precisely stated proposition is either true or false. Give you a minute to look at that there. As long as you precisely and clearly define what you're talking about, then we can know that something is true or is false. If I say, Bill is bald, well, as long as I precisely define what a bald person is, someone that has 100 hairs or less or something, then I can know, and I know you guys are chuckling as though you're thinking about somebody bald in the audience or something. As long as I precisely define what a human is, and scientists have done so, then everything either is or isn't a human, right? According to the law of biogenesis, a non-human won't give rise to a human. So again, evolutionary theory contradicts the findings of science and requires that very thing to occur. Evolutionary theory is not in harmony with the scientific evidence on this matter, but again, the biblical model, perfectly in harmony with the evidence. God created life. He created it according to its kind, told it to reproduce according to its kind. Genesis 1:11, 1:20, 1:24. The biblical model doesn't have the problem of having to make this jump between across phylogenic boundaries, between various creatures. God created life according to its kind, and those kinds have remained constant since creation, since the ark, with only small variations occurring, changes which amount to micro rather than macro evolution. Now, the idea that life comes only from life of its own kind leads us into another discussion, which I'll discuss somewhat briefly The typical response by theistic evolutionists, by this point in my seminars, hey, you know, you haven't really disproved evolution. You've just disproved naturalistic or atheistic evolution. You know, God could have still used evolution and just stepped in at those places where he was needed, like with the origin of matter and energy, the laws of science, the origin of life. Well, the problem with that is, number one, we can know that the Bible is inspired because of its divine characteristics, and it doesn't leave room for evolution. I briefly discussed that in the first session. We got a lot of material on our website that deal with that. Number two, we're not given enough time for evolution to occur. I'll discuss that more in my fourth session tomorrow morning. Number three, the evidence for Darwinian evolution is lacking, making it a blind faith, which I'll discuss more in the third session. And number four, there is no mechanism for evolution to occur, which I'll discuss briefly now. Darwin's evolution has itself evolved for decades, really for millennia. Evolutionists have to admit that it can't work the way that they thought that it could. The evolutionary timeline is constantly having to be changed. Dates change as to when various animals supposedly lived, and the order of evolutionary development has changed constantly. New theories as to why various animals develop various body parts are constantly having to be adjusted. In fact, evolution itself didn't even originate with Charles Darwin. Many people don't realize that. Forms of evolution have been around for millennia, and for millennia those ideas have to be revamped as, guess what comes in? More evidence. In order to try to keep it in harmony with the latest scientific understanding. Darwin came along at the right time in history for evolution to really become popular. So he's typically credited with coming up with it and is considered the father of evolution, but he by no means started the whole idea. Now, a fundamental component of his version of the theory was this idea of natural selection. And natural selection is the idea that nature selects those species that are more fit or more suited to an environment for survival. And those species that aren't as well suited, if they don't migrate, they're going to die out. And that's by and large true. And the creationist doesn't have a problem with that idea. We believe God worked that into the created order. The problem is, Darwin believed that natural selection could be the means by which one kind of creature could create something else, another completely different kind of creature. The idea that all forms of life could come about from previously existing less complex life starting with a single cell eons ago. But scientists have realized Darwin was wrong about that. Natural selection alone couldn't cause evolution to occur. Evolutionary paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard, he said, "The essence of Darwinism lies in a single phrase. Natural selection is the creative force of evolutionary change. No one denies that selection will play a negative role in eliminating the unfit. Darwinian theories require that it create the fit as well. And therein lies the problem." Evolutionists recognize that they can't even claim that natural selection could create the fit. Dutch evolutionary botanist Hugo de Vries long ago said, "Natural selection may explain the survival of the fittest, but it cannot explain the arrival of the fittest." So evolutionists have realized natural selection can't cut it. Enter neo-Darwinism. Neo-Darwinism is the idea that natural selection, if you couple it with genetic mutations, so DNA accidents, that'll give you this mechanism for this change, for evolution to occur. But that claim has problems because genetic mutations don't create new raw material or information, which is necessary for the kind of change required by evolutionary theory. Speaking of that very issue, British engineer and physicist Alan Hayward said, "Mutations do not appear to bring progressive changes. Genes seem to be built so as to allow changes to occur within certain narrow limits and to prevent those limits from being crossed. To oversimplify a little, mutations very easily produce new varieties within a species and might occasionally produce a new, though similar, species. But despite enormous efforts by experimenters and breeders, mutations seem unable to produce entirely new forms of life." Stephen Jay Gould, who I quoted a moment ago, said this concerning mutations. "A mutation doesn't produce major new raw material. You don't make a new species by mutating the species. That's a common idea people have, that evolution is due to random mutations. A mutation is not the cause of evolutionary change." Now, when he says a mutation doesn't produce major new raw material, that's an important admission. New raw material, new information isn't added to the genome in a mutation. Let's think through the implications of that. In the printing of a book, or even the copying of a book, like a file, a digital file electronically, you ever notice sometimes errors will turn up? Mutations will turn up. when you examine the finished product. For example, individual words could be messed up. So a few letters of a word could be changed to other letters. These are termed codon errors in genetics. Duplication could occur. This is the idea that words, sentences, even entire paragraphs could be duplicated in the book somewhere. Translocation could occur. This is the idea that chunks from one part of the book could be moved from one area of the book and inserted into another area. Deletion could occur. This is the idea that chunks of the book could just be lost. These kinds of errors, these kind of mutations can occur in our genes, and there are others. But notice no new material is written when these errors or mutations occur. A new sentence hasn't been written into the story, has it? The problem is that the theory of evolution requires new sentences and even chapters to have been written into the genetic book. In fact, doesn't it even require sequels of the book to write themselves into existence? Really? Codon errors, duplications, translocations, deletions, these are mutations, but mutations don't add new information. They simply change something that already exists. They alter what's already there. They may cause a fly to have extra wings, a fish to have an extra eye, a person to have an extra toe, but they can't create a new kind of creature. A mutation wouldn't cause a wing to appear on a creature unless the creature already had wings in its genetic code. In other words, using our book example, no new paragraphs or chapters can be written by mutations. Now, what that means is that if a living entity doesn't already have the genetic code to grow new parts, it can't grow them. If you don't have antlers in your genes, you can't grow them. If you don't have webbed duck feet in your genes or feathers, you can't grow them. If you don't have tank tracks in your genes, you're never going to be able to roll on over to your neighbor's house and carry out a tank assault, right? It really doesn't matter how long you live and how long you mutate. And that's why evolutionist Pierre-Paul Grasset, who was the chair of evolution at the Sorbonne in Paris for over 30 years, he said, no matter how numerous they may be, mutations do not produce any kind of evolution. Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan, just like Gould and Hayward, came out and strongly expressed their disagreement with the idea that genetic mutations could be the mechanism for evolution as neo-Darwinism contends, which, remember, this is the mainstream belief now, this whole neo-Darwinism idea. They said, mutation accumulation does not lead to new species or even to new organs or new tissues. Evolution contends that life started as a single cell and over millions of years has resulted in the human race. Neo-Darwinism theorizes that mutations could allow that kind of change. But in reality, that kind of evolution requires the addition of libraries and libraries of information into the genetic code. Raw material that simply cannot come about due to random mutations. Guess what information is always the product of? In everything you could ever come up with in your mind, information is always the product of a mind. Always is. I really go into depth into this more in my book. If this is something of interest to you, be sure to check that out. Also, there's a book called Genetic Entropy, The Mystery of the Genome, which is written by a guy that's not a member of the Church of Christ, but it's a death blow to this whole idea. He's a population geneticist, guy that designed the gene gun and is famous for that. The science we've looked at really just in these first two sessions, the equivalent of mounds and mounds of scientific evidence, totally dismantles the first four fundamental planks of evolutionary theory that I showed you last night. Recall this chart from that first session, which details these fundamental planks of naturalistic evolution, as well as the response by the creation model. Yesterday, we saw that the laws of thermodynamics and the law of causality prohibit the first two planks on the evolutionary chart. The universe could not have created itself or be eternal, and life requires a cause. Now, that evidence alone is enough to destroy atheism, but there's more. Recall that the creation model is in harmony with those laws. The laws of probability now add further weight to the fact that those planks are not in harmony with the evidence and yet support the creationist contention that the universe came from God. The law of biogenesis further illustrates that abiogenesis cannot occur and neither can macroevolution, since life produces according to its kind. Again, the creation model is in harmony with this scientific evidence. And finally, the evidence from genetics illustrates that macroevolution cannot happen. Neo-Darwinism, the mechanism for macroevolutionary change, is false because mutations, which are a fundamental component of Neo-Darwinism, do not provide new information. Once again, the creation model has no problem with the scientific evidence, since the nature of genetic mutation and the creation model harmonize with each other perfectly. The creation model doesn't have to rely on Neo-Darwinism to explain the existence of the kinds of creatures we see on Earth today, since according to the creation model, God created all creatures according to their kind. The laws of science were written by God. So, of course, you would expect them to be in harmony with the creation model. But when we study the evidence, the evolutionary model is riddled with issues. A few years ago, Philip Yam wrote in the journal Scientific American about new ideas that get brought up in the scientific community that contradict solid, proven science. He said, certainly there should be room for far-out, potentially revolutionary ideas, but not at the expense of solid science. Now, he wasn't talking about evolution, but what a telling statement. What can be more solid science than the laws of science? What can be more solid than that? And what theory comes more in conflict with the solid science from those laws? You know, it's a mystery as to why evolution can be even deemed a scientific theory, since it doesn't have supporting evidence for several of its most fundamental planks. Now, if upon gathering scientific evidence, a person continues to find constant contradiction with a theory, and finds that there seems to be this never-ending readjustment of a theory to try to keep it in harmony with the evidence, at some point, one should wonder whether that theory should just be thrown out in favor of a theory that does not constantly contradict the evidence. Wouldn't that be the logical approach? Wouldn't that be the scientific, unbiased, unprejudiced, rational approach? Shouldn't a person be pretty suspicious of any theory that has to be continually revamped over and over throughout the centuries and even millennia just to keep it alive? You know, the creation-evolution debate is like a competition. It's like a race where two sides have come up to the starting line. They're trying to figure out which model is the true account of the origin of the universe. And everybody's lined up there. And the more evidence that each side gathers to support its model, the more the race car moves towards the finishing line, proving that its model is the correct view. And that's how many, I think, view this creation-evolution debate, like this race. You know, we win. I saw this chart that says, we have the fossils, we win. I'll talk about that in the next session, I think. But really, this is not even an accurate parallel. A more accurate parallel would be the two cars come up to the starting line, and before the race begins, the race to even start gathering evidence, the race authorities walk up and announce that evolution can't compete, it's not a valid entry in the race, it hasn't completed its paperwork to even enter the race, it's disqualified, because its race car specifications don't meet the standards specified in the rule book, the laws of science have been violated. You know, in science, there's oftentimes several possible theories that could all explain some phenomenon. And that happens a lot. But they're possible theories because they don't contradict the evidence. And they're reasonable. They're a possible reasonable explanation as to what could be going on. I don't have a problem with theories. We just don't know for sure yet what may be going on. We've got theories about how to explain alleged biblical contradictions. We've got theories for that. We don't know for sure always what exactly is going on. We've got theories. So evidence is gathered to try to find which theory is best. But evolution can't even qualify as one of those possible theories because it violates the laws of science before the game even begins. So creation doesn't have competition. It's really in the race all by itself. Bottom line, if evolution is true, science should support it. If creation is true, science should support it. Why would science lie? The truth is, science supports the creation model and not the evolutionary model. And notice, creationists don't have to jump through hoops to stay in harmony with the evidence. Creationist platforms perfectly in harmony with the laws of science. We're comfortable. And shouldn't that describe anybody that's holding truth? You know, one shouldn't have to adjust and jump through hoops to maintain a belief if it is the truth. But notice, evolutionists are constantly having to adapt and come up with new theories to try to postpone the inevitable. The theories that they propose have no basis in fact. They're just frantic attempts to prop up this failed theory and at the same time try to create this illusion that they have some kind of scientific substance, and one day will be verified. But notice carefully, each time the new revised theory is shown to be false, guess what's still standing like a lighthouse? It's these laws of science. To anybody that's unbiased and interested enough in finding the truth, there is a lawmaker, he governs the universe, and he's just waiting for people to realize that. The material from these first two sessions is what is covered in my book. The next three sessions are not covered in that. Also, it's really only about half of the book. The second half of the book is the responses that the atheists give to this stuff. And my responses to that. That's really half the book. About half of it is appendices dealing with that. You know, quantum mechanics. You know, why couldn't quantum mechanics create the universe or whatever? So it deals with all that kind of stuff. Make sure that you either check our website and find that material on our website or get a copy of that book to make sure you're ready to deal with the latest in this. The rest of the material is covered in this DVD that we really just released, I think 1 week ago, 1.5 weeks ago. In December, I went and recorded this seminar down at World Video Bible School, and we have that now available to you. So a lot of this material from all the whole seminar is available in that form. In the book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, as I wrap up here for just a couple minutes, atheistic philosopher Daniel Dennett argues that spreading the atheistic agenda must start by indoctrinating children at the earliest opportunity, including teaching children that parents who don't believe in evolution are teaching falsehoods. Niles Eldridge agreed in the triumph of evolution and the failure of creationism. He says, "I maintain my conviction that the real battleground is in the classroom." The atheistic community has made significant progress in pressing their agenda in the classrooms. And many children in this nation are being indoctrinated from a young age to disbelieve the Bible and its teachings. And as you know, it's been going on for long enough now that we've got a lot of people leaving the church, young people, especially when they go off to college, because we've had it shoved down our throat, not just in science classes. Have you noticed it? It's in art class. I mean, history. You're going to see it in history, too. It's everywhere. We take that pretty serious. I think the Brotherhood does. At AP, we've really been taking that serious the last several years. And so we've been trying to develop a line of materials that is aimed at kids. In fact, I would say they probably do better than our adult stuff these days, as people are recognizing the need for some of these kinds of materials to start combating what's going on in the classroom. So I want to make sure that you are aware of some of these products. A lot of people, whenever we set up the display, you have no idea what you're looking at back there. So I like to highlight some things, help you to know why we have what we have back there, and help you to know what you're seeing. For infants, cards, you know, we're on the back. It has information for parents to read while the kids get to see the other cards. Information about God's creation. Kids love it. We even have this Learn to Read series. You know, Dr. Seuss, you know, Dick and Jane, these are good and fine. Why not use a book that teaches the truth about God's creation whenever kids are learning how to read? Doesn't that make sense? Well, that's what we thought. So we've developed three series of books that are for that. You know, this early reader and Learn to Read series and this advanced series that teach kids about God's creation. We even have some Bible books. This is not really apologetics related, but these are rhyming Bible books, a series that we've been doing. You know, discovery is one of these secrets of the Brotherhood, I believe. A lot of people don't even realize we're finding that this exists. This is a Christian Evidences magazine, monthly magazine that's set up for kids to get that are ages really 3rd through 6th grade. I mean, so it's, you know, it's targeted at them on their level, and it's got activities in there and so forth. And I try to recommend to people to think through, what can you be doing with this? You know, you could set up a subscription for a neighbor, and it would just start showing up at their house. You know, without you even saying anything. Or maybe you have a niece or a grandchild that needs to be getting this. And I try to encourage people to, you know, we don't make anything off of it. I mean, it's like $14 for a year. So it's a little bit more than $1 per month per issue. It's not much. But imagine what that child is getting every month. It's not just Christian Evidences. There's also other Bible truths and so forth in there. Material aimed at them. There's literally nothing like this on the market. Dinosaurs Unleashed, and it's even being used by the homeschool curriculum, Sunlight. And this, of course, teaches kids the truth about dinosaurs, what you would predict based on what the Bible says. If evolution is true, then dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago, and humans never saw them. But if the Bible's true, we were both created on day 6. and we saw each other and we interacted. And there's some evidence of that in the book of Job and so forth. This examines some of that, has lots of beautiful illustrations that help to try to depict what may have been the case, what kind of circumstances may have been the case. And it looks at the evidence historically and scientifically and biblically, all kinds of evidence for kids. And at the same time, teaches them a lot about these individual species of dinosaurs. We also have this interactive book where we've taken Dinosaurs Unleashed and made it available for like iPads, and it's interactive. So it's got a ton more information in there. In fact, this week at PTP, I had my son, Davey, the whole time while I'm speaking, he's there on the front row, and he's being able to look through Dinosaurs Unleashed, you know. And so there's a bunch of pages. There's even a dinosaur coloring pages that they can color with their fingers, you know. I'm not suggesting you do that during church, but PTP, you know, that's a lot for a little four-year-old to get. So this is called an interactive book. We also have one now called Wonders of God's Creation that is now in interactive book format. And this is great for kids that age. You know, pictures speak 1,000 words, don't they? When you think of dinosaurs in your mind, chances are you have been influenced by the evolutionary community, because it's always depicted based on the evolutionary mindset. You know, so you're never going to see humans interacting with dinosaurs. You're never going to see them coming onto the ark, right? You know, it's going to be the environment that they believe that would have been in existence 65 million years ago. It's totally foreign to what the Bible would teach. And that you don't think that impacts kids in their mind? You know, we have people that will contact us and be just vehemently disagreeing with us having humans and dinosaurs interacting, and they're Christians. Because in their mind, they have these pictures of dinosaurs that are based on evolution. They don't even know that they've been influenced. Well, we recognize, especially with kids, pictures are very influential, and we need to take back the monopoly. And so we've been designing this series of posters for kids' rooms. I say it's for kids' rooms. I probably had more adults saying that they get these and put them in their offices and stuff, and it's a major spark for conversations. People are like, what's the deal there? What's that? Well, I'm glad you asked that. Let me tell you. I mean, it's great. It's great for that. I think my wife's got two of them in our front hallway when we walk in. They're beautiful posters trying to depict what may have been the case. We have material for 4th through 6th graders that teaches them on their level, how do you know the Bible is from God? How do you know God is real? So existence of God at their level. You don't think kids at that age need to be hearing this? Need to have it taught to them on their age? Wonders of God's Creation, written by Eric Lyons here in the last year or so, looking at many of the amazing animals that God created, beautiful pictures and so forth, teaching kids the truth of creation and that evolution is false. Does God like to paint? This is written, you know, how many of you, when you were growing up, had the opportunity to study space with two members of the church that are astrophysicists? Not me. Branyan and his wife Alana are both astrophysicists. Imagine what the conversation around the dinner table would be like. I can only imagine what that'd be like. Branyan is actually out at World Video Bible School, but he's one of our auxiliary science writers. He writes for us when he has time. But they look at space and teach kids about the universe. On their level, it's fascinating to be able to do that. Again, there's nothing like this book on the market. This is basically, it was written to kind of be like a textbook that you could set down beside a biology textbook the kids will be going through in, what, 8th or 9th grade maybe. And it goes through like the biology textbook, so here's the evidences for evolution. Well, this book then counters all of that in basically the same format. It looks like a textbook and so forth. I recommend to parents to have one of these and basically have kind of like 8th period when the kids get home from school, where you can sit down and counter everything that they just learned and basically have a Christian evidences class using this textbook. I know individuals that do that. All right, we've got tracts. A lot of people don't realize we have tracts that are aimed at kids. Not just Christian evidences stuff, but we have this morality tract series. I want to make sure you're aware of those. And we have this new line of T-shirts that, let me tell you, at PTP, they sold like hotcakes. You all know what Digger Doug is, right? Digger Doug, I'll tell you, let's see, I don't know if I have anything in here about Digger Doug. I'll tell you about that maybe tomorrow. Digger Doug is our Christian Evidences show for kids. Kind of like Barney, but Christian Evidences style. I can't stand Barney. I'm sorry, parents, I can't. And my kids love it. I don't understand that. Anyway, Survey of Christian Evidence is for teens. Two books on that, and they're 13 chapters, so they're designed to be like something could be taught in a class for a quarter. And there's discussion questions at the end of each chapter. Kyle has actually written the third one, which is helping teens deal with modern atheism. And it's, I think, actually at the printers right now and will be available hopefully in the coming months. We also now have this new Christian Evidences magazine for teens. We put it out just twice a year, basically every 6 months, and again, targeted at teens. We also have T-shirts that teens like and adults like, which this one says Defend the Faith, and then this other one that has Always Be Ready to Give a Defense on the back of it. Also, you probably are aware we have a couple of Vacation Bible Schools available now, one on creation. I don't remember if you all have done these or not, but we've got one on the Inspiration of the Bible, one on creation. And of course, we have this new Bible class curriculum, which I'm sure you all know a lot about, and it's free for ages 2 through grade 4, but a lot of people are just using it for homeschooling and for teaching their kids at home. And then we have the Explorer series for grades 5 and 6 on that. And be sure to be aware also of this advanced Bible reader we have on our site, which is also free. And it basically makes it where you can have your kids read a section of Scripture, and then they get on this website and take a little quiz to see how they did, and they get points for it. And then, you know, they can gradually build these points up, and they're kind of competing against the other people on the website and so forth. And you can even set it up the way we're doing it at Panama Street. I'm set up as the teacher, and all of the kids are in my group, so I get to see everybody's points at the same time, and as they get to a certain mile marker in points, then I can hand out a certificate to them or something like that. Also be aware of our summer camp, if you're not aware of that, which fills up really quick in starting in about February. So, yeah, that's our graphics artist right there, Rob Baker, if you don't know him. All right, thank you for your attention. We'll take about a 10-minute break before we launch into our next session.